The views expressed on the Final Straw Radio do not necessarily reflect those of Asheville FM, Friends of Community Radio, or any of the affiliate radio stations airing this show. You're listening to WSFM LP 103.3 in Asheville, North Carolina. This is The Final Straw, and I'm Bursa Goodness. The show can also be heard on KWTF in Bodega Bay, California, KOWA LP in Olympia, Washington, and WCRS in Columbus, Ohio. The show will later be archived at thefinalstrawradio.noblogs.org. You can also find us on iTunes, and you can email us with questions or suggestions at thefinalstrawradio@riseup.net. Also, if you're interested in rebroadcasting any episode or segment, feel free to do so. Just send us an email so that we know that you're out there. If you care to, you can send us letters at The Final Straw, care of Asheville FM, 864 Haywood Road, Asheville, North Carolina, 28806. The show is brought to you by Firestorm Books and Coffee. Located at 610 Haywood Road, Firestorm Books and Coffee is a worker-owned cooperative in Asheville specializing in offbeat, underground, and independent literature. You can find a sample of Firestorm's catalog of books and zines, plus a full calendar of events at their website firestorm.coop. After the election of Trump as Pot USA, cities around the U.S. have seen huge protests. Portland, Oregon, in particular, has seen over a week of intense protracted street action in which people faced off with police and reactionaries in the street. As such, there have been many arrests, and there are some facing felony charges. There's a request for assistance in fundraising for arrest support. Mateen Abdul Shahid is a 20-year-old youth of color who was arrested on a felony warrant and is currently being held on alleged charges of 6 counts of criminal mischief in the first degree, which is a Class C felony in relation to ongoing events in Portland. Please consider raising some funds and donating to Portland Anarchist Black Cross's GoFundMe, www.gofundme.com/support-fund-anti-Trump-activists. This is a great time to start developing regular fundraising strategies to support resistance and to up our games. For ideas on Solly parties you could hold to fundraise and where you can raise awareness, drop us an email at thefinalstrawradio@riseup.net or check out fundraising needs at itsgoingdown.org.
Welcome to the podcast version of this week's show, which is a conversation with two Asheville anarchists named May and Julie about current events right now, this idea of a general strike, their thoughts, and where to go from here. Please be advised, I guess, that there are some swear words in this episode. If you hate that, we can figure something out. Enjoy. But first, here are some words from anarchist prisoner Sean Swain. What you say, what you say?
I'd like to share with you a recent event here at Warren Correctional that just might demonstrate in full living color just how mentally ill these wackadoodle fascists are. This event involves three prisoners, Collins, Rammel, and Raypole, one of whom lived in the honor block, and two of whom had received a security decrease at the time that this happened, and they were only waiting to transfer to lower security. Now Collins, Rammel, and Raypole are the women's bathroom three. So here's what happened. On October 5th, the three prisoners had visits. Their female visitors all used the bathroom. While in the bathroom, their visitors put things in the trash. That's it. What they didn't know is that the prison investigator, Marty Jones, had placed a hidden camera in the women's bathroom. Jones, whose nickname is Bow Chicka Wow Wow, reminiscent of the guitar lick and the porno background music, claims he was granted permission to install a camera in the women's bathroom. Of course, what investigator Bow Chicka Wow Wow Jones doesn't mention is that he got permission to install the hidden camera in the visiting room in the women's bathroom from the captain of his bowling team. That permission notwithstanding, Bow Chicka Wow Wow Jones didn't bother asking a judge, as the law requires, and he didn't turn over the footage to the judge before viewing it, as the law requires. That means Bow Chicka Wow Wow Jones committed a felony by watching women use the bathroom in Warren Correctional's visitation. According to the conduct reports issued against the three prisoners, their visitors were observed placing what he terms packages into the trash can. Of course, Bow Chicka Wow Wow didn't view the video until the following day, so he didn't recover whatever was put into the trash, so he has no clue what it was. But that didn't stop him from concluding that it wasn't used maxi pads, but was instead.
This call is originating from an Ohio correctional facility and may be recorded and monitored.
but was, instead, drugs. Bowchikawowow doesn't reveal how he can conclude that packages he didn't recover are drugs, and he doesn't describe how the three male prisoners plan to get the packages of drugs out of the trash in the women's bathroom. By the conduct reports, the three prisoners did nothing at all. While accused of attempting to procure drugs, there's no description of any conduct at all, indicating that Collins, Ramble, or Raypole broke any rules in any way. They went to a visit, sat through the visitation, and then went back to their cells. Now, because the three female visitors used the bathroom and used the trash, those visitors are suspended. Further, all three prisoners were railroaded through the Rules Infraction Board, where the total and absolute absence of any evidence never stopped Lieutenant Nelson from finding prisoners guilty. The two who were slated for lower security are now stuck here for at least another year, and all three are housed in the sanctions block, where privileges are greatly curbed. All of this, not to beat a dead horse here, without recovering whatever went into the trash, and without any idea where it went, and without any theory as to how the three prisoners intended to get the unknown items from the trash. But I think the most disturbing thing about all of this is the creepo fascists who run Ohio's prisons have given themselves permission to put hidden cameras in the women's bathroom, contrary to existing laws, and on the basis of some ridiculous pretext that anything tossed into a trash can is drugs. So on this pretext, how many female visitors have been secretly recorded on video using the bathroom? If female visitors coming to see me use the bathroom and place trash in the trash can, which is where it goes, is Bowchikawowow Jones going to decide they are drug pushers and exile them for life? We're talking about fascists who have decided that using the mail makes you a gang member, telling the truth on the radio makes you a terrorist, and civilians using the trash in the bathroom makes them drug pushers. I think this signals their absolute irrationality, their complete lack of regard for the harm they inflict on people, on human beings struggling along under their oppression. There's no reforming a system that's under the mismanagement of the Bowchikawowows of the world. The only answer is to topple the entire machine by any means necessary. Let's make September 9th a reality every single day of the year. Free the Women's Bathroom 3 and fire Bowchikawowow Jones. You can call Warden's assistant, Gestapo Greg Kraft, at 513-932-3388, extension 2010. That's 513-932-3388, extension 2010, and express your rage. This is anarchist prisoner Sean Swain from Warren Correctional Institution in Lebanon, Ohio. If you're listening, you are the resistance.
You can write to Sean Swain at Sean Swain, 243-205, Warren CI, P.O. Box 120, 5787 State Route 63, Lebanon, Ohio, 45036. For updates on his situation, his bid for U.S. President in 2016, and more writings by Sean can be found at seanswain.org. Thank you both so much for coming to the studio and talking with me about this stuff at this time.
Thanks for having us.
Sure thing. Would you mind introducing yourselves and talking a little bit about what y'all do?
Well, my name is Julie, and I guess what I do. Well, in terms of the kind of anarchist-affiliated work that I'm involved in Asheville, I work with the Prison Books Project. I'm a member of the Firestorm Collective and recently doing a fair bit of work around prison and prisoner solidarity, which kind of kicked off with the September 9th prison strike, but is ongoing and right now looks like putting together an ongoing bail fund, and that's in the works. So it's a major project. And then, of course, just trying to figure out what a comprehensive community response to the election of Donald Trump is going to look like.
My name is May. I'm part of the Firestorm Collective that operates Firestorm Books and Coffee.
Who underwrites this show?
Oh!
Yeah. It's a conflict of interest.
Well, gosh darn it. So that takes a lot of my time, and I kind of participate, try to organize small projects here and there when I can. Mostly I just post on social media a lot. Mm. Mm, but some people like it.
I like it.
What is your opinion as somebody who interfaces with social media about, like, what social media is doing to stuff right now? If that's a question that makes any sense at all.
It partially makes sense if I'm understanding what you're asking correctly. I think that it is fully understandable for if anyone wants to just totally disengage with it. Mm. But at the same time, it's how a lot of people do communicate, and whether they're repeating the same old ideas that they have or they're getting new ideas, it seems like valuable for me at least to say these things somewhere, because that's a place where I do have a platform versus someone that has, you know, like I can't get up on a literal soapbox these days, although I would if someone had one. So that's kind of getting a lot of people to maybe interact with material that they wouldn't otherwise interact with. And it's not necessarily like the most earth-shattering or glamorous thing, but I kind of feel like I don't want to step away because someone needs to say something.
Yeah. Julie, do you feel like talking about the article that you wrote at all?
Sure. Yeah, I was thinking when you asked the question about social media, I was thinking I'm like the opposite. I engage a little bit on social media, but not very much. I prefer to kind of collect my thoughts in a maybe like a more formal setting or way. So I wrote an article actually a number of weeks before the election, although ultimately I didn't end up posting it up online on Medium until a few days before the election. And it was called, the title is Trump is What Democracy Looks Like, which is kind of like a dig at some of the like activist rhetoric and chant, protest chant language, because as an anarchist, like I have a critique of democracy. So it was kind of a dig at that. And basically the gist of the article was to point out kind of the inherent contradictions and limitations of democratic political doctrine, which are always present, but I think in this particular election cycle were like really prominent and perhaps more obvious to people who aren't even necessarily anti-statist, because you had kind of for the, I don't know, maybe first time in all of American politics, but certainly in very recent history, openly authoritarian rhetoric. We've definitely had like racist rhetoric and misogynist rhetoric and homophobic and transphobic and classist rhetoric pretty consistently, usually more toned down, more coded, but that's been pretty consistent. But the authoritarian streak was something that felt new. And because authoritarianism is seen to be like in direct counterpoint to democracy, it was really interesting to see like a candidate progressing through, not until after the article was posted did we even know that it was going to be to the end, but you know, progressing through who was espousing that ideology and actually his that not really seeming to bother people. And the people who it was bothering were people who I would consider like Democrats or progressives or liberals. And it seemed interesting to me that the very people who he would alienate the most with that kind of rhetoric, it was their adherence to that those democratic ideals that would actually ultimately prevent them from speaking out against him if he actually did become the president, which, I mean, I'm sure we'll get into this in the rest of the interview, that ultimately is what we've seen happen, is a lot of complacency, I think.
Yeah, definitely.
So that was, I mean, that was the thrust of it. And the reason why I wrote it was to point those things out, but also just because I was concerned that I really didn't hear anyone giving any credence whatsoever to the fact that he could actually win. Mm-hmm. Like, it was constantly brought up as a fear tactic in order to get people to vote for Clinton. But then it didn't seem like anyone was creating any kind of mobilization plan if he did win, or any kind of plan B, contingency, whatever. And that was concerning to me from a practical standpoint, because I felt like, what if this guy gets elected and we're not ready? But also, again, from like a theoretical standpoint of why aren't people engaging with what that is going to mean for them and the choices they're going to make in the face of a legitimately elected authoritarian demagogue. So I kind of concluded that the reason that people weren't doing that thinking into the future was because they simply did not want to actually confront those contradictions. It was more comfortable to actually put themselves and the people in the country in danger of being governed by someone like this. It was more comfortable to have that potential than to confront the internal contradictions of democracy. Yeah.
And I remember talking with you about this as you were writing it, but you expressed that anarchists are not who you wrote this article for. Who is your intended audience, and have you gotten any feedback after the election on the article?
Yeah, actually, that's a good question. Yeah, the intended audience is not anarchists in the sense that, anarchists will probably already kind of agree with the general, like, gist of it. And I should give out, a shout-out to Crime Think Podcast, because it was, like, after listening to their two episodes about democracy that, like, got my wheels turning on this, like, definitely helped me, like, clarify a lot of my thoughts around a critique of democracy. So in that sense, it's definitely, like, part of, like, an anarchist theory. But the audience was kind of for, again, these like liberals, progressive Democrats, not really to persuade them. I'll be honest, it started off and there were drafts of it that were far more snarky and mean-spirited. I'm not naive enough to believe that I can convince, Democrats and liberals to abandon democracy for like a more conflictual or anti-status position. But I do hope that my hope was that by articulating what these contradictions looked like to me, and by kind of there is not really a call to action, but in near the end there is a kind of like, so this is on us / this is on you guys who are voting and who are voters, to kind of pick up the pieces if this is what happens. So yeah, that was kind of the hope, was that honestly, by the time I posted it, I was just like, well, I spent a lot of time writing this thing and like, I don't want no one to read it. So like, yeah. Hillary Clinton's going to be president and it'll be irrelevant, but like whatever. My parents will be like, you're a good writer, which was some of the feedback that I got. Thanks, Mom and Dad. But, so it really wasn't even necessarily to galvanize people after the election, because I wasn't even thinking it was going to go that way. But I have gotten a lot of feedback. I was hoping that even if that was the case, people would still, it would kind of give people a moment of pause about like reflecting on their own, kind of ideology and where that might bring them / us. So the feedback that I have gotten once the election did happen was that it was, kind of freakishly like prescient and kind of creeping people out. So I haven't honestly gotten much like critical feedback in the sense of the kind that I would want, which would be like poking at or pulling at some of my ideas and being like, hey, but did you think about this? It'd be nice to have more of a dialogue around it, honestly, but I haven't. This is the part about being bad with social media, is like, you throw something up online and then you're like, I'm not going to look at what people say or anything. I don't know. I actually did get kind of freaked out today because I like saw how many people had like viewed it, and I was like, yeah. That's too many people.
Whoa, cool.
but then like no one like recommended or shared it, so wow. It's okay. But I don't know. I would I it's interesting. I wrote it for Democrats, but I want to hear feedback from anarchists. Yeah. You know, that's more who I like would be interested to actually discuss the ideas with.
Definitely. So we are here to talk about what seems to be on everybody's minds right now. Maybe some people feel really talked out about it, but I think that there's a lot of room for speculation and analysis. And there has been, like I said before, that from a lot of different perspectives. I was wondering if y'all would talk about your initial reactions to this election and also talk a little bit about how you were feeling about it or how you're thinking about it almost 2 weeks after the fact, given kind of the immense amount of action that has happened, also the immense amount of internal and external struggle that has happened with it. Vis-a-vis, like, social media and in real life. I was wondering if y'all would talk about that some.
Yeah, I was not surprised. I know a lot of people were surprised. And there have been mainly, I guess, probably in tucked away in academia, which is unfortunate, but articles about the resurgence of fascism in the United States. and elsewhere, too. And particularly the similarities between the United States under the current administration and the Weimar Republic, that, like, the conditions were such that, like, someone like Hitler coming to power was a feasible reality. So I wasn't surprised, but I was disappointed, and I was more disappointed, and not at, like, Trump winning or Clinton losing, but at the very predictable mass response where people that had been saying, like, we can't work with this guy, he's literally Hitler, or, like, he's a misogynist and this is unacceptable, like, how can this person be president, are suddenly like, oh, maybe it's not so bad, like, no big deal. And, or, like, you know, saying that, like, we have to give him a chance and we have to work with him. And there's actually there's a New York Times article from 1922 where they wrote, several reliable, well-informed sources confirmed the idea that Hitler's anti-Semitism was not so genuine or violent as it sounded.
Oh, no.
And there was some elsewhere where, and it was in one of the local Facebook groups, people were talking about how we needed to mobilize because we, like, this is kind of horrifying. And someone said that they weren't going to get too paranoid because there weren't whatever death camps and stuff. I don't know what you think, prisons and deportation centers are, but that's fine. And if there were to be an American Kristallnacht, that would be the time to get out into the streets. And there were five years of, like, anti-Semitic legislation leading up to Kristallnacht. And that was before the outbreak of World War II even. So I'm mostly just, like, furious at people who have, like, constantly, like, we have to learn from history, like not let history repeat itself. There's a Holocaust museum in Washington, D.C., and suddenly this is fine. Anyone that's ever said that they would go back in time and shoot baby Hitler and are saying that they're going to work with Donald Trump now is a hypocrite.
I mean, never again means, like, maybe in 60 years.
We have, yeah, this intense amount of, like, historical myopia and I think that, like, mass media and liberal media in general is using this as a platform to, like, be the, like, racist, sexist, classist, misogynist, you know, machine that it is, being like, oh, like, poor white people voted for Donald Trump or whatever the fuck, and, like,
and we have to listen to their voices. We can't forget about them. They're ignored. They're forgotten.
Yeah, and, like, how, like, rhetoric has devolved in some circles to, like, peace policey kind of talk and stuff like that, and, like, you know, as a way to, like, denigrate militant tactics. And to be like, oh, no, we just need to have love. We need to have, like, a unity rally. We need to have love Trump's hate, which I fucking hate that chant, by the way. It's a really poor play on words, and anyone who's listening to this should consider just not using it at all, in my opinion.
I think I would just add to that I think there is also this aspect of American exceptionalism that is part and parcel of, like, all of –
are issues mobilizing and the roadblocks that get thrown up by kind of like progressives and liberals who want to critique the system but don't want to fundamentally question why that system is the way it is in the first place,
yeah.
And really just don't have an analysis of power. And so there is this sense, I think, that it's just like people can't conceive, even though everything that May just said is like completely spot on, people don't think it can happen here, even though, again, like you said, it's already happening here to certain groups of people.
Definitely.
Who are invisible.
Mm.
And what were we going to say?
I think I just wanted to add, too, that I, on a personal level, it's like very, it's been very anxiety-inducing because my family's not from the United States. And on the one hand, like, I don't have an accent and stuff, but my parents do. And I feel like historically when there's like this level of like threat, that the circles of who is impacted spread wider and wider. And so and you just don't know who is like, I don't know, just driving down the street. I'm like, is that cop now going to be extra empowered to hurt or kill somebody?
Mm-hmm.
Like, I don't know. I just don't know. And that's horrifying. And I like suicide rates have gone up. Calls to crisis lines have gone up. And the fact that that's kind of being ignored, like, why, like, love and unity needs to be with those people that are like hurting and scared because they're going to be impacted on some level. I mean, that includes us for sure. And not the oppressor. That's very upsetting. And then I see a lot of people that don't know what to do and are like, well, we better organize for midterm elections, or like, mm-hmm. well, in four years from now. And I'm like, that is how you got here. Like, why is it so hard to imagine anything other than waiting to elect somebody else to be in charge of whether or not you're going to live or die?
What do y'all think about the anarchist response so far? Like, I have a tendency to fixate on, like, liberal responses because it just, like, as an anarchist, liberal responses to things, and to be clear, like, not all liberal, whatever, hashtag not all liberal, but, like, what I have started calling toxic liberalism just sucks all the air out of the room, and I would
also
love
it. Also wildfires.
Also wildfires, we'll do that. North Carolina's on fire right now, but, like, I would love it to not suck the air out of this tiny little recording studio. So I was wondering if y'all had any responses to the anarchist engagement that you have either, you know, witnessed or participated in or heard about. What do y'all think about that?
Well, we're just getting started, so I'm not really sure I have I can really like reflect on kind of like the strategic usefulness or whatnot of what we're doing. I think we're getting started in a good direction,
mm-hmm.
but just, I mean, I'm with you on the toxic liberalism and also like the toxic like self-soothing whiteness thing, which is like really it's almost, I mean, I will answer your question about anarchist organizing, but I think this is an important like delineation. This liberal is like a hard word to kind of engage with sometimes. It has like different meanings for different people. What I see in the aftermath of this election on social media and also in conversations is less a breakdown by like political bent and more often like a breakdown by like race or mostly that, honestly. This sense of like, it seems to be that many white folks want to like distance themselves from the election results. If they weren't a Trump supporter, they want to find a subgroup of whites who weren't supporters of Trump and like identify themselves with that. So whether that's like wearing the safety pin or being like, I'm a millennial, which is not even true because white millennials went for Trump more than they went for Clinton anyway. So again, that was like a racial breakdown, not an age breakdown.
Mm.
But that's like my pet peeve.
God, millennials ruin everything.
Apparently.
So just, but so the, I've been seeing a lot of that, and like May said, like, oh, we just need to organize toward the midterm election. So like, yes, that is irritating to me as an anarchist because I'm like, really, the cure for voting is more voting? Thank you very much, voters. But it's additionally problematic because, like, no, I'm not going to wait 2 years for someone else to do something. Like, yeah. That's infuriating. Even if voting was a good cure for voting, you don't get it to do it for 2 years, and who knows what's going to happen between now and then. So I really do feel like I think the thing that crystallized this, like, white people self-soothing for me was suddenly, like, one day after the election, like, it was two or three days after the election, like, every non-anarchist white person I know was saying that it was okay because Michelle Obama was going to run for president in 2020. And I was like, there's so many things wrong with this statement. Sorry. That I don't even know where to start. Like, first of all, you actually have zero information to back that statement up. Yeah. Second of all, see above voting, see above waiting 4 years. Third of all, I mean, is this like another replay of like the magical Negro trope, like that we need again, right? Like, yeah. We just need for a savior to come, you know, save us with their magical exotic qualities and they'll make it better for all of us. And it's just... It's pretty disturbing and it's pretty disgusting. Yeah, but then I also heard from anarchists of particular tendencies, oh, well, you know, this is just the collapse of industrial civilization and it all needs to burn to the ground anyway, which, mm-hmm. like, sure, agree. But
the burning to the ground is not working out well for us right now.
Right. There's a lot
really
of
hard to breathe.
And so, I mean, that's fine if that's your tendency and that's your position, but... It is, again, this, like, it feels to me like this cavalier, self-soothing attitude that really is only accessible to people who don't feel that they are on the front lines of who's going to be affected by this. Yeah. And that seems pretty clear. And when you have those divisions between people who really are going to be impacted by policies and people who frankly just aren't as much, at least in the beginning, that's when you get... I feel the window for complacency that we are seeing right now, and people are like throwing that window wide open and waiting for authoritarian policies to waltz right through it so that then by the end, you know, the window is smashed, yeah. Not in a good way, mm-hmm. And then we're all just screwed.
Yeah, and just to clarify a piece of terminology that was used.
Yes, please do that.
Julie talked about that magical Negro trope or social construct. This is a movie thing, right? It was
like a literary device.
A literary device that was
both,
like a...
What is it? Or like the exceptional also.
Yeah.
Exceptional magical. Like Morgan Freeman getting roles where he's like this... token, like, wise old black man, and there's like hardly any other black people around, and is giving them all these powers that are somehow like supposed to take away the fact that like we're Morgan Freeman to just like walk around in the street and people didn't know that he was Morgan Freeman. He's not safe.
Yeah. And in the character, literary devices or movie devices are characterized by the fact that they have no other defining quality except to save white people from themselves, or like to save white people from the like poverty, emotional poverty of their existences. Okay. Another similar literary device is the magic pixie dream girl thing, which is a post-cursor, I believe, to the magical Negro device. So I just wanted to clarify that.
Thank you so much. Yeah. And that's a really well said definition too of that. I'm gonna use that.
I read Wikipedia. Did you have anything else to add to that discussion, May?
Election things?
Anarchist responses.
Oh, anarchist responses. Yeah. Well, we do have so many anarchist organizing. Isn't that a contradiction jokes to look forward to? So there's that. I'm a little bit... it feels a little bit overwhelming because it feels like anarchists that I know are the only ones that are responding. I mean, not exclusively, definitely, but anarchists and maybe other political radicals are the only folks responding in ways that seem to be like they might be effective in the long term. And I guess that's good, but I feel like very unprepared. I think other people feel very unprepared. And there's also some, not sure if I can speak for anyone else, but kind of a sense of panic that like there hasn't been mobilization, that we've just been like, I don't know.
What do you think it would, because I've been coming up against this discussion a lot, this issue of preparedness. What do you think it would take to like feel prepared for this, or like to be prepared for this? Yeah. It's a really big question.
I think that there's a lot of issues kind of internal to like various communities that I'm aware of, and the fact that it's been such a struggle to address racism and misogyny and kind of like class elitism within like the radical left is really hard, because I'm still like seeing people saying more eruditely worded, but along the same lines of like no war but class war, and it's like, no, that's not how it fucking works. Like, sorry, class war. I mean, I'm for it, just not exclusively.
Yeah.
So that feels really hard. And also just not having the same strength in numbers and militancy as I've seen in, like, anarchist responses to crises in Europe, which, like, again, still really challenging, but it just feels a lot like there's greater numbers and greater, like, solidarity, like, real solidarity. Mm-hmm. So I could just be in, like, outside impression, but
and also in Europe, like more of a, well, this is in my extremely superficial understanding of it, but like a more vibrant anarchist and more like immediate anarchist history, and no shit, no shade, but like less repercussion and sentencing.
For sure.
So yeah,
and a less precarious, well, I mean, I can't speak to other people's existences, but in terms of, like, a wider base to draw from, American people and workers are in such a precarious position in so many ways that really discourages, I think, building a movement. And I was just reading about this in a recent book, this idea of, like, kind of the inheritance of, like, now, like, 30 years of neoliberalism, 20, 30 years of neoliberalism, has been to create so much powerlessness that it's really, like, incapacitated people's ability to even conceive of what struggle and resistance look like. And I feel like I'm seeing that so much with the reaction of so many people, of just not even knowing what, like, a terrain of struggle would be. So, I mean, one of the questions you asked was about the anarchist organizing. And one of the things that, you know, I've heard and gotten excited about was this idea of a general strike. Mm-hmm. But I'm excited about seeing where it goes. But at the same time, I have felt kind of hopeless about it, because I know that the conversations, I know that the conversations I have with people who aren't necessarily already, like, politicized, people are going to look at me like I have three heads. Like, yeah, I don't like Donald Trump, but what does my job have to do with it?
Yeah.
And I think, you know, for folks who maybe have a more robust political history to draw from and a, like, present culture, like, political culture, which I think does exist perhaps more strongly in Europe, the link between the way that power is, like, a thread that runs through, like, politics to workplaces to social relationships, it is more apparent to people. So I've been thinking a lot about how to try to explain to people why, you know, why a strike tactic would be relevant to protesting a political administration.
Yeah.
And even for me, it's, like, a little, like, okay, wait, why? You know, I have to think about it. But I also feel strongly that, and basically it's like the ability to disrupt, you know, it's where you show that you have power. So that's one tech.
And it's like a tool we have, like the tool of refusal, I think, is a pretty potent one, or it can be.
Mm-hmm.
So right after my thing about liberals that I said earlier, I would I have that question about liberals that I sent to y'all, which was, in any situation like this, what seems to come up pretty frequently for anarchists is engagement with, quote, liberals or toxic liberals, perhaps, trying to inject messages of hope and love, which pretty much, like, from an anarchist, or from my anarchist perspective, I guess, pretty much only serves to dilute and mischaracterize anarchist strategy. What is your opinion on engagement with liberals? Is ignoring them a useful tactic, in your opinion? And is there any room for useful engagement with folks?
So that's a question I've been thinking about a lot, because it's something that was discussed recently among friends. And I think that there's what I've seen from my interactions with people that I know is that because the like of the hegemonic nature of like neoliberal ideology and of the like weird capitalist party structure where there's never even the option. It's kind of just like the liberals or the conservatives, and there's no like sometimes arguing about things like healthcare reform, being against it, not like because I don't think people should have healthcare, but because like health insurance is not care, first of all, like I, you know, all kinds of things. And people would just immediately kind of lash out about like, why don't you want people to have the thing? Like, I have diabetes and now I can have insurance. And I'm like, I can't afford my copays because I'm poor. So, but there's also people like in that framework that are left of liberal and just like haven't maybe done as much reading or haven't had a kind of like exposure to some radical ideas. And I think that like expecting people to come to anarchism and like on their own is counterproductive, and that when you look at the history of anarchism in the United States and when it was like at its most vibrant, possibly people were doing speaking tours and making newspaper headlines, and like not everyone wants to be in that position for sure, but the fact that there was that kind of visibility for these like alternative politics to the mainstream was, we don't have that now. We have to make our own media, and we do that, and that's still like not reaching out. And so if there's folks that are open to like hearing these ideas, you know, like a lot of times people want to know like, oh, when did you like really become a radical or whatever? So there's always that moment. It's not like, you know, you come out of the womb or whatever and you're like, fuck cops. I mean, maybe, but so I think there's room for engagement with people that are open to it. And I've had people, you know, respond positively to things that I've said, and that makes it kind of feel like worth engaging. But on the other hand, there's people that are gonna like keep insisting that if you hate fascism and you want to like defend yourself and fight back and like take the initiative instead of just waiting, then you also are just as bad, because that's, I don't really understand why there's no, well, I guess they're, like Julie said earlier, there's no power analysis and assuming that all forms of violence are the same. And also that violence is only, like, a particular kind of violence. There's no look at structural violence, like the violence of not saying anything and letting, you know, being complicit in things is not discussed. So, yeah, there, it depends, basically. And also, if you don't have the energy for it, I don't think anyone needs to, like, put themselves on that horrible, horrible treadmill of arguing with somebody that's not down to listen.
Yeah.
I actually feel pretty excited for partnerships and collaborations and working together with a lot of different groups of people. I mean, I have no interest in creating space for just more hand-wringing. I mean, that's not even action, you know? Mm-hmm. So it's one thing to, like, go to a street protest and have people with signs and chanting things that don't represent your political position at all and maybe kind of the nature of liberal that you're talking about. And there's always going to be those people, and that's fine. I mean, I guess I prefer that they're at least out in the streets than the people who are like, well, I guess he's just the president. There's nothing we can do. But beyond that, as we actually get into the real mobilization against the policies that he's putting forward, you know, I think that there's going to be tactics that are very clearly marked by not necessarily that the people who are doing them are like card-carrying anarchists or whatever, but I think that there's like some hallmarks of what are considered like anarchist tactics of self-defense, community defense, autonomy, you know, direct action. So making sure that people in your community know how to do abortions or healthcare when those things aren't available, or if those like reproductive health is threatened, things like that. So just making sure that the skills are present in your community to meet the needs of your community, right? Like that feels very much like something that I associate with like an anarchist tendency. But then there's all these other things that we've kind of, at least in this session, been talking and kind of like implying a lot about, which is this more like generalized societal taking over by, you know, an authoritarian regime that could even potentially be fascist at some point. And that inherently goes, it does go beyond any particular tendency and really affects everyone, although some more so. And I think that what's going to be exciting is working with people and maybe stretching ourselves to set aside some of our knee-jerk reactions as anarchists. It'll be necessary. I mean, for instance, just to get like specific, like an example is this question about sanctuary cities. So you've seen across the country mayors of larger cities, LA, Chicago, New York, Seattle, coming out very strongly against this idea of secure communities, which is the program by which, you know, ICE collaborates with local level law enforcement to drive deportations and detentions for immigrants. So you see these mayors coming out against that and proclaiming that their cities, which are currently sanctuary cities, so cities that don't fall under the purview of that program or have resisted that program, will continue to resist that program, even under a more repressive and aggressive regime. And that's great that they're doing that. So, but one of the kind of arguments that they make whenever they talk about sanctuary cities is explicitly that the reason that those administrations support being sanctuary cities is because it allows law enforcement to build trust in the community. Mm-hmm. One of the reasons, like one of the most popular arguments against having secure communities, is that it prevents law enforcement from being called, like, because people are scared that they're going to get ICE involved. So you often have people being like, you know, the police chief comes out and says, you know, we don't want people not to call us. We want people to call us. And if we have secure communities, then people won't call us. And so it is very likely that we'll be hearing that kind of argumentation as we go forward, and as people inevitably in Asheville and beyond call for more local level kinds of commitments to resisting collaboration with ICE. And as an anarchist, that obviously is not my priority to build trust within communities when it comes to collaboration. To law enforcement. But at the same time, you know, community self-determination, and if that's the line of argumentation that people want to use because either they believe it or they just think it's the best way to get the policy they need in place to protect their communities, I think that we can have conversations as individuals and as fellow activists and things about whether we agree with that or not. But I don't think that like sitting around rolling our eyes at the rally is like a good idea. Like, if you don't want to hear that rhetoric, just sit that one out maybe, and decide whether the larger goal of like preventing mass deportations is more important than like offending your anarchist sensibilities or whatnot. And also, I think that the critiques of things like law enforcement that doesn't just exist in the anarchist community, or it doesn't just exist in, like, the non-immigrant anarchist community or whatnot. Like, there are plenty of critiques of law enforcement that come from within those communities, and it's way more productive of a conversation to have the critiques of law enforcement come from within the community and be like, hey, you know, actually, law enforcement is not that great. These are the ways that law enforcement hurt our communities. And we definitely don't want ICE involved, but we also don't want to make, you know, our communities like a haven for policing either. And those conversations will be more productive when they're coming from within those communities than, like, anarchists who are not necessarily as affected on the front lines of an issue like that are like, oh, well, I wanted to work with this, like, rad group until I heard them, like, talking about the police or whatever, you know.
Yeah. Are you suggesting that we, like, bend somewhat, like, be somewhat more willing to, like, work outside of our, I hesitate to say comfort zone, but, like, our politically ideological zone? Or is that what you might be advocating for?
I'm not suggesting that any individual does anything that they don't feel comfortable with, but I think that as we enter into this work, just being aware that, like, when you are working with people who don't identify as anarchists, you're going to hear some things and you're going to encounter ideas that are not necessarily in line with yours, and it would probably be a responsible thing ahead of time to think about the ways in which you're going to enter into dialogue with people that you disagree with, or, you know, what kinds of actions you are or aren't comfortable with, and just, like, do that work, that thought work, you know.
I also want to add that depending on what the goal is, like, if there's a common goal, which is protecting people from deportation, like, yeah, the cops are going to be like, yeah, people should, if this happened, like, people should be, like, free to call us if there's an issue. But I don't see any reason why the work can't be happening, like, to both establish, no, maybe not establish, like, end a relationship with ICE, and while at the same time, like, continuing to build alternatives to policing. And, like, if there's people in that group that are like, well, this is the group that's doing something, so this is why I'm here. Like, there's, I personally, just because of it's what I do for work, like, I will always recommend readings and post things. So there's really great critiques of, like, community policing, which is a big in favor a lot of places now, even, like, about how even that concept just expands the reach of law enforcement and, like, the scope of the criminal justice, in air quotes, system. So I think that being absent from those groups altogether means that people don't get to hear alternatives and don't get to hear a critique of their own, like, engagement. And that if you are in that situation and you decide that you, like, really cannot work with these people, that's totally, you know, like, someone's choice to make. But to stick to a really hard line, I guess it makes me wonder, like, if the what's important to you is, like, being, like, the best anarchist, or, like, living by a code of morals and ethics that, like, matters to you. And I would rather, like, prevent people from being deported than, like, win anarchist points.
Yeah.
Ditto.
Well said.
Which is kind of why I was distinguishing between, like, liberalism versus toxic liberalism. Mm-hmm. Like, the people who for example, use the rhetoric of hate. What are they talking about when they talk about hate? Like, what are they talking about when they talk about violence? You know, what are they talking about when they talk about this, that, or the other? Like, low voter turnout, or millennials, or whatever the fuck, all these things have become such, like, strong buzzwords for, like, or you know, strong
stand-ins
for other words, or for other concept. Yeah, and I think that there's a huge, like, discrepancy between those who would seek to ideologically annihilate any tactic that isn't their own, and those who seek to, like, prevent deportations. Not by any means necessary or too, like, but yeah, that's why I was trying to make that distinction. But yeah, I see that.
And, like, the reality of an empowered like white supremacist, white nationalist base is that like it is, there's so many fronts. Like mm-hmm. every institution is open to, I mean, it already is. Like that's the thing, is this is all on a continuum, right? Like we haven't been living in some golden age utopia up until the moment that Trump was elected, right? So, mm-hmm. so much of what we're seeing is only an intensification and a continuation of what's always been there.
That's such a good point. Yeah.
That's just the way that that this country is. So I think we've developed a lot of strategies already that have been useful. I mean, most people, I think, who listen to the show probably know that under President Obama, you know, more people have been deported than under any other previous administration. So it would be quite shocking, frankly, if Trump is able to deport more people than Obama did. So this is on a continuum. And the reality of this, like, even more emboldened, right, is that, like, schools were already seeing awful things happening in schools. We're seeing, like, trans women attacked in parks, all kinds of horrible things. So it really does feel like people just need to, like, plug in where they are mm-hmm. with who they can. And that means, like, coworkers and people in just the people that you meet, and I don't believe in like only working with or talking to people who share your politics, and that will definitely not create any kind of like societal pushback to creeping fascism mm-hmm. to only be doing that. So it's necessary, and it's actually, I think, exciting to think about all of the different kind of sites of engagement that we'll be working on.
On the schools issue, it has been really cool. I get really kind of emotional about it to see also schools being sites of action. Like in the DC area, which is where I grew up, there have been mass walkouts by students, like in DC and Maryland. I'm not sure about Virginia yet, but at least in those places. And not to put recently, kids from the high school that I went to walked out and everything and like stood around with signs. And then there was another student a white student showed up wearing a like Make America Great Again hat or whatever, and he got jumped. And there was a whole big argument about like whether or not is violence wrong, and he was just wearing a hat. And again, to that I say like structural violence, like supporting hateful rhetoric and bigotry, like that's coming from the people in power, is violence. And good job, kids that jumped that other kid. He was not very seriously injured.
So, like, not to pick on you, but I think that's an example of a place where, like, so many of the parents, not just of the kid that got jumped, right, but like parents of the kids who probably did the jumping, were probably really upset about that, and were totally like not on board with, you know, kids taking their anger and frustration and, frankly, their trauma, their understandable trauma out on this individual representative of that trauma, who was also, like, probably just some stupid kid. And so, like, those are the kinds of conversations that's going to push us. And we need to be able to, or I believe that I want to be able to come to those conversations with my own perspective, but also, like, I don't even have kids, mm-hmm. you know? I've never had to raise a child and kind of send them off to this institution where they have all these experiences and contribute to the formative experiences of other kids. And I just... like, for those conversations to be productive, we need to understand that just kind of like the pure anarchist line won't necessarily, not that it won't, I mean, I don't even know how to say it, because I agree with that line, you know, but just that there's going to be a range of perspectives, and that in order to continue to be engaged in a meaningful process of like, how do we approach that kind of situation and make it transformative for everyone would be like the ultimate goal, right?
Yeah.
Like, and I don't know how to do that from scratch, but I would love to be able to like bring that perspective to like parents who are really upset and be like, hey, this, but also this, you know, and that's a challenge for everyone.
Yeah. And the kids that were the students that were responsible for the, I hesitate to call it violence just because of the rhetoric. I guess the people that were like
the jumpers
in this case, being like students of color pushing back against this white kid and it being from that area, like that is not like a poor rural kid. That is a middle class or higher white student. And the kind of like continued, even in like a very like pretty progressive area, the continued like marginalization of students of color is a serious issue. And so, I mean, I think that in an ideal world, none of this would be happening. But if moving forward, like, yeah, that could be a conversation and like having a transformative justice process where people can talk about like why having someone walk up with a Make America Great Again hat evokes that response, and like for that kid to have to like practice some empathy and understand. I mean, I don't know if that would work, but
yeah.
But those are like the challenges ahead.
For sure. And speaking of the pure anarchist line and the challenges ahead, I was maybe to expand on the question that was asked before. It's pretty telling to me how like many anarchists have been discussing like tactics and like calling for assemblies and having meetings and so forth. And it seems that like based on that tactically, a lot of people like within anarchism are on like pretty similar pages regarding like crisis mode or whatever. But that being said, is there anything like tactically or strategically that are there things that aren't being discussed that you would like to see getting more play? I know it's super, super early days yet. That like it hasn't even been 2 weeks or something like that. So,
I know. We're so like, why are we already?
Yeah,
but it's also been 30 years.
It has also been 30.
What happened 30 years ago?
Oh, maybe it was 40 in neoliberalism.
Oh. I thought you meant... like, I'm 30, so...
Oh, that's true.
What am I
also,
waiting for?
30 years ago...
Anarchy was born.
In the Soviet Union of all places.
Well, in Asheville, I haven't heard... Actually, not just in Asheville. I think because Trump's rhetoric really focused super heavily on some specific groups that were, like, named, like Muslim folks and, like, undocumented folks, there's definitely been a lot of attention on how to provide, like, solidarity and support to those communities. Obviously, his anti-LGBT rhetoric has been so blatant that folks are definitely, like, gearing up to engage in self-defense and all different kinds of things. But this idea of him being kind of like the law and order candidate or president has kind of, not that it's slipped under the radar, but it's like more amorphous, right? And it's like clearly coded, to me, it's clearly coded language that is like targeted toward like black folks. And I think that the prospect of stop and frisk becoming a national policy and him, like, tapping, like, Rudolph Giuliani, who was the mayor of New York when there was a huge expansion of stop and frisk, is really, really concerning. And that it's been harder, I think, for us to kind of, like, pin down what needs to be done to respond to that. And I think that that kind of, like, goes back to the continuum thing of some just kind of mind-blowing nature of anti-blackness in this country is such that it's always it's just like a constant feature of life. Like violence against black bodies is just a constant feature of life in the United States and other places as well, but particularly in the United States. So it's like hard to point to the moment it got really bad and we needed to mobilize. I mean, there have certainly been points in history when like more concerted efforts have been prominent and in the public eye. But like that, I think, is another replay. I mean, again, like you see, you know, mayors of major cities talking about going toe-to-toe against the president of the country and like possibly like passing up like millions of dollars of federal funding in order to affirm the value of the lives of immigrants. And that is great and that is amazing and those lives are valuable. But like, where is the public affirmation of the value of black lives? And that never had, like that affirmation never comes. And part of the thing that allows it to never come is that our racially coded language is so deeply entrenched that like Trump doesn't have to say shit is about to get seriously repressive and violent toward black folks. It's just understood and it's just expressed in so many ways that like then there isn't this moment where people can be like, well, this is what how we're going to engage with like, you know, a movement for black lives. I mean, I guess that's like a quick way of saying it is like we need to perhaps be more concertedly like engaging with the movement for black lives, which is expressed in many venues, not just like Black Lives Matter or whatnot. But that's like a platform that I think we could and should be talking more about, not just like a narrow issue of like cop watch. Like I've heard people be like, oh, we need to set up a cop watch, which like, sure, definitely watch the cops. But that is, again, it's like, oh, we need cop watch. That's not, we need to show up for a movement for black lives because this is a moment of intensification of violence and repression against black people. And we didn't have to have a speech where Trump said, like he said, like Mexicans are rapists and murderers. And so everyone was like, oh, we need to like support Mexican folks and undocumented folks. Or like he said all these horrible things about women. And so we need to like affirm that women matter. There was no moment to be like, okay, we need to affirm that black lives matter. So I would like to see us talking more about that.
And it's been interesting to me just to respond really quickly, if I can, like to see the ways in which we have been and are like prepared for this broad sort of eventuality. Like for example, with all of the anti-prison and Afro-pessimist and like anti-blackness analysis that has been coming out, I think we're uniquely positioned, perhaps in all of history, and not really in all of history, so and I can't really say that. But like maybe we're uniquely positioned right now to do something like that. Mm. Also within healthcare, like there are so many anarchist people and queer people and people of all races in healthcare right now, and have been preparing for that eventuality for like a decade or more. So I think that like the resources that we have and the resources that we have access to is really important to look at too. But yeah, I think that we just have to step up to that. We just have to fucking step up to it.
Like they won't name it, so we have to name it.
Yeah.
I think something else kind of, I think this relates to what Julie said and what you've said as well, is that there's this perception, like, yes, things are intensifying and it's kind of like, oh, this is the nightmare world is like feels a little more real. But constantly being like having to defend and react rather than like taking initiative is something that, because like the, like, you know, deportations have been happening and like violence against black lives has been happening. And yes, there's definitely been actions taken and then it kind of like, I don't know, it dies down. And I, on the one hand, I do understand that we're all struggling. Everyone that I know is coping with a lot. And I wonder how to move to a more offensive rather than defensive position. Like, that's something I would like to discuss, because if things are, like, if things die down and whatever happens, like if Trump goes and then something, well, then I don't even want to get into the vice president. But if Trump goes and then, like, Hillary's magically, like, Hillary Clinton's magically president, like, are all the anarchists going to be like, ah, fuck, cool.
Phew.
I needed, like, a nap. And it's like, I do need a nap, but also I don't want that, like, kind of, like, the fire that's been lit to go out. Like, I think that it's really important to – where are all the accelerationists, by the way? I haven't really seen a whole lot of those folks yet. And your time is now. Yeah, so just getting a little bit more – not, like, not aggressive, but putting things forward and, like, just understanding that, like, the more that we act, like, strength in numbers is a real thing, and, like, mutual aid and solidarity are, like, real things, and that we can be finding ways to support each other, hopefully, with whatever is necessary in order to, like, keep going. Because why are we still here in 2016?
We kind of already touched on the topic of the general strike, but I was wondering, May, if you had any words about, like, what you thought about the tactic of a general strike.
Yeah, I am so 1,000,000,000% for it. That number is not real, but neither is anything. And I think that what I really desperately want to see is that, like, I think that it's going to, strikes have been shown to be effective, and they're very dangerous. And that's why when people used to really go on strike back in the day, like, there were private guards hired and, like, the National Guard was there and people got killed, and that's scary, but people are already getting killed. So, like, what, you know, you can, like, take action and take a risk, or you could, like, do nothing and you're still at risk, to be honest, if you're any kind of marginalized person. And so I really am excited about it, but I really hope that there can be some kind of effort to really talk to people about why the tactic is important, why it's effective, and to figure out how to kind of address the fear that prevents mass actions from occurring, which is that, you know, people sit to themselves and they're like, well, if, like, I go on strike, but no one else that I work with goes on strike, then I'm going to be, you know, like, I could lose my job. Like, I got to feed my kids. Lisa needs braces, you know.
Or I just feel silly.
Yeah.
Like, I'm the sucker.
Yeah, yeah. And so, like, addressing that fear and figuring out a way, because, like, people participating at every level, like, from all kinds of demographics and stuff, is going to be really vital to its success. And that's not possible if there's, like, a lack of trust that people are going to have your back, or, yeah, like, figure out how to deal with this thing in a way that, like, doesn't bring more harm to folks that are already experiencing harm. But I'm really excited by the potential. I hope that it's less disappointing than Obama. It's hopes and dreams. Yeah.
May, can I ask you a follow-up question? And Adrian, you can answer this too. Oh my God. Day is night, up is down. The interviewee is upend the pyramid. Hierarchy for never. And, like, it's so great to hear someone, like, be so for the strike tactic, because I was totally, like, waning in my excitement because of all the things that you just mentioned, of just being like, no one else is going to do it and they're not going to get it. And, like, so, I mean, that is really great to hear you be so excited about it, because it makes me re-excited about it. And I love the idea of having these conversations and strategizing ahead of time about how to make that case to people. I'm curious if you've given any thought to... People will probably ask, like, well, what's the demand? Like, usually in a strike, there's this idea of a demand that's trying to get met. And so I was just, like, wondering if y'all have ideas about that.
Just silently hand them a copy of We Don't Make Demands and then pull up my bandana and run away. No, just kidding. or, like, back away like Homer Simpson into the bushes. No. I think that talking about the I do agree with the idea that, like, making demands does kind of presuppose that there's people that can grant your wishes, and that I would like to see, you know, like, just people mobilizing because they give a shit, and then seeing the, like, possibility of strength in numbers, which we, like, really don't have. We're all kind of atomized and alienated. Thanks, late capitalism. And so that's part of it, but I know that it is going to come up. So I feel like whatever answer is going to be honest and will impact that particular person, because likely I'm going to be more successful talking to people I know about it rather than, like, you know, some strange man or something. I'm sorry.
It's okay. You can say man.
I didn't mean to sound so disgusted.
Man.
Sorry. I'm so sorry. Someone I don't know. Men are people too. Okay. That's fine. I feel like I've alienated enough liberals by telling them that voting is wrong, so and that Hillary Clinton is also a misogynist.
I loved your post that was like, you wouldn't lift a finger to help me, like, not go to the camp. Fuck you. That was the best one.
I mean, it's just I'm serious. They're terrifying. So right. So in terms of demands, I think that when talking about I do want to be clear that getting rid of Trump is not the idea. Like, being like, we don't want Trump, we want Hillary. No. I mean, but if someone is gonna go on strike because that would be an outcome that would satisfy them, I'd just be like, all right, just come on out and we can figure it out later. And then tell people that, like, maybe rather than having a demand for a strike, that this is like taking direct action. It is riskier than the fucking safety pin, but, like, fucking do it, and, like to show people that are scared for their families, their lives, their loved ones, their family integrity, whatever, that people, like, care enough to mobilize in some way. So, like, yeah, I would say that would be part of my response. Probably I'll have to think about it more, and that's a really good question to pose. Thanks, Julie.
Yeah, thanks, Julie. Cool. It was cool to be out of the interviewer chair for a second. But I did not even think about the possibility of a demand until you posed that question. But in the, like, 3 minutes that May was talking, I was like, my wheels were spinning a bit, and I think that, like, for me personally, like, if I am asked about demands, I probably will not really say much of anything except, like, it's not about demands. It's about, like, a refusal of the far right and a refusal of, you know, everything that has happened and everything that has been happening up until this point. Violence against, like, marginalized communities is not anything new. It is not a thing that's just started since, like, Tuesday the 8th or whatever the fuck date it was. Just, like, a refusal of the far right, a refusal of the alt-right, employing a tactic that, like, I can employ, you know? And, yeah, that's about what I'd say, which, like, won't really satisfy all that many people, but maybe will satisfy me.
I'm, like, loving the word refusal right now. That word keeps, like, coming up for me a lot, just in my brain, like, total refusal. Yeah. I will say, like, in my thinking about it, I would also, like, say, actually, this isn't about demands, partially because, like, as May kind of showed, like, there isn't, even if we believed in making demands as a tactic, there's, like, no good demand for this because it's about electoral politics.
Sean Swain.
And now a word from Sean Swain. Yeah.
I just want to say his numbers have probably been getting suppressed, and that's fucked up.
Release the report.
Yeah.
but also because, like, how would we agree on a tactic? It would be impossible, and it would be besides the point. I feel like the message that I want to let people know about why a strike feels good is that it is a show of force, mm-hmm. like a show of potential force and power that people have. And the idea is to, for us all to know what kind of collective energy we can harness and to show that collective energy, because the day that has been floated for the strike is the day of the inauguration. So it's obviously not like a preemptive action to get him to like step down or something. That doesn't seem to be the framing of it. It really is a message, right? And so I like the idea of people finding out for themselves and showing to others on the day that he gets sworn into office that, like, this is what we can do. This is probably only a fraction of what we can do because we're not actually out here striking for any actual particular specific fucked up thing that, wait, these are so many swear words. How are we going to put this on the radio?
No, it's cool. I'm going to censor y'all.
Thank goodness.
Sorry. You know now, an hour and 20 minutes into the interview, so.
Thank goodness.
Yeah. Better yeah. late than never.
I am not voting for you ever.
Yeah, like if we can get this unruly and like get a bunch of people to skip work and like, you know, damage productivity, hopefully, and like profits for a day, just because you are like passing from the like amorphous gate from like citizen to like ruler, imagine what we can do and what can we can shut down when you've actually done something messed up that we want to try to prevent or reverse. Yeah. So it's like it's practice and it's basically a warning in my mind.
For sure.
Yeah, and like not to get too academic about it, but like from the perspective of like something like social psychology, okay, there's a really good article a while ago about the psychology of school shootings and anti that, but and also school. They talked about protests and how there's someone that like, if they saw a crowd that was doing something, they would be like motivated to join by the crowd. And then like the people that are in that crowd were maybe motivated by like people that were, I don't know, yelling or something effectively. And those people were motivated by like one person throwing a brick through a window. And so on the one hand, not that like to put too much emphasis on like the fact that there needs to be like one that's like the initiator of the movement or whatever, but but that like building critical mass is how to also challenge this perception that we are like a bunch of like a powerless electorate and that all our options are shit and crap. Like, I don't really want to pull one of those levers. I would rather have, like, you know, real food, and if I have to take it, then that. Yeah.
Or that, like, all we can do is symbolic action.
Yeah, yeah. And I will say this, too, that I think that it's important in terms of the strike to talk about how just people just staying home is definitely going to make a big difference, but also people taking their day off, hope the weather's nice, to maybe go outside for a walk, holding a sign, you know, something.
Maybe go on a road trip if that's what you want.
Yeah, yeah. DC is great. So many museums, which I hope will be closed. That's a thing. But there's all kinds of ways to participate. Also, I would like to mention that the call for the strike, or at least one call that I've seen, mentioned no housework, and just want to, like, put a shout-out to, like, unpaid labor that also upholds the economy. So just leave the dishes in the sink. It's fine.
There's so many ways that we could go from there, but since we've been talking for so long, I might endeavor to wrap up the interview. And I only have two further questions, and those are, like, do you have any words for listeners who are getting, like, more targeted since the election, or who maybe have been getting targeted and now they're now the violence against them is like more sensationalized and more like spoken about. And do you have any words for them?
It's hard to know. I feel like finding words is hard because what a lot of the messaging lately has been, like the conversations have been, that it's like talking is one thing, but saying, you know, like, I support you, it is like kind of meaningless without taking, you know, action to support someone. So I don't know. I guess in general, like, there was a really good tweet that showed up, I think, on Facebook, as they do, and a really good essay that someone wrote, like, or long post, not essay, but one, the tweet said, taking on off that quote that everyone says, you know, first they came for the whatever. So they wrote, first they came for the Muslims, and we said, not this time, motherfucker. So one, that, and two, someone, what did they write? Right, that a lot of people saying maybe it won't be that bad and da-da-da-da-da, and just that, like, the only reason it might not be that bad is if we make sure that it is does not get to be that bad. And so if people are feeling, you know, an increased threat or hopelessness or despair, I just there are people that care about you and about each other and community and, like, the value of life. And, like, you're the people that deserve love. And, like, standing in solidarity with people that are facing harm is, like, the kind of unity that I can get behind, not fucking hugging a cop. So, yeah, just love and support, but, like, real support.
Yeah, it's hard to come up with, like, a generic statement because people want different kinds of support and different kinds of, like, responses. You know, some people, when they're getting messed with, they find a lot of power in just being really stoic, you know, and some people want someone who will help, like, you know, mess someone up with them, you know. So it really depends. But I mean, in terms of, like, my people who I've, you know, been sending messages to, I think I've just been trying to express that I hope people are getting, you know, offering support and offering hopes that that they're both finding the support that they need as well as giving support to other people. Because I think, like, no one is just a victim, you know. So just being like, I'm here for you, you know, call me. Let's hang out.
And I might say, as somebody who is a very, like, somewhat negligible shade of brown, though it has been more of an issue since the election and has been an issue in the past as well, as far as people who don't like that, I would say people are keeping an eye out, and people are watching, and people are watching the alt-right, and they are watching fascists and Nazis and racists and, you know, the people who feel great about being alive right now. That people are watching, and if that gives you any sense of solidarity or whatever, that's great. Also, it's okay if that doesn't do it for you, and, like, not knowing what you need is totally okay too, and people asking what you need about this, and I might cut this out, but, like, can feel like a bit oppressive, because you're just like, I what I need is for this to never have happened before. Mm-hmm. You can't do this for me. Nobody can do this for me. So, like, that's what I might say. Do y'all have anything to add at all? I mean, I'm sure there's so many more directions this interview could have gone in, and so many directions that it could potentially go, and we could probably talk about it for a really long time. But do y'all have any closing words or anything you wanted to add that, like, didn't get touched upon in this interview?
I just want to thank you for the opportunity. It was really nice to be here and to actually get to say these things, and not just, like, type them furiously at 3 a.m. So, gratitude. And also, I don't know if you saw it, but you could put it up if you feel like it. But I wrote, if anyone is, like, having a time, particularly with the rhetoric of, like, of what violence is and is not, like, shamed or condoned. I made a very brief reading list that I posted up. so if anyone needs those, it's, like, not nearly very comprehensive, but it's something.
We'll include it in the blog post.
I also appreciate you taking the time to talk with me and us.
May and Julie, thank you so much for coming on to the show. It's been always a pleasure, and it's awesome to be in community with y'all, and I feel really lucky to have y'all as comrades.
Thanks for listening to the podcast version of this conversation with May and Julie. Check out our blog for that reading list that May mentioned, and we will also link to some Afro-pessimist and anti-blackness writings that Julie recommended. You're listening to WSFMLP 103.3 FM in Asheville, North Carolina. This is The Final Straw, and I'm William Goodenough.